Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible, educational, and fun. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak. I'm here with John Wells. This month, Scientific American explores the Bitcoin and blockchain technology in an 18-page special report. Jen Schwartz, who's the editor of the report, will join us in the first half to talk about the currency that's making huge waves in the economy and, gee, in conversations all over the place.
Everywhere you go.
Yeah, that's right.
Good morning, Lynn. Finally, the science of why alcohol is like poison, not just for some of us, but for all of us. Cool Science Radio speaks with Annie Grace, author of The Naked Mind.
Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters. It's Cool Science Radio.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Hospital, a not-for-profit community hospital supporting KPCW. While you may never need to outrun a cheetah, the sports performance team at Park City Hospital can help you do so using our new high-speed treadmill. Whether you're an elite athlete or just looking to better your PR, our team of experts will help you run faster, get stronger, and increase your agility. The high-speed treadmill is designed to go up to 31 miles an hour, allowing you to outrun and outlast the competition. And cheetahs. Call 435-658-7350 to book a session.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, here with John Wells. The concept of blockchain or Bitcoin technology has most of us really in a tailspin, wondering what it really is. And I'll be frank, over the holidays, I heard a whole lot of millennials and Generation Zers talking about how they know a dude who knows another dude who made $13 million in trading Bitcoin in 2 weeks. And I think a lot of people had those same conversations over the holidays. Well, separating the stories from the fact is the role of our guest, Jen Schwartz. She is the Bitcoin expert at Scientific American magazine and has now edited an 18-page special report on the topic, The Future of Money, Explaining the Cracks in Our Financial System and How Decentralizing Technology Could Make Our Global Economy Better or worse. There are three features in Scientific American in the January issue. And Jen Schwartz, we're so glad you could join us to help us unravel the Bitcoin. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, maybe we should just start with this. What I said in the intro is that I think people of our generation are saying, wait a minute, we've heard about Bitcoin, we don't really know what it is, and it's time we find out because, wow, it has the economy and maybe all of us in a tailspin. And it seems as though Scientific American had that same take. Why did you decide on an 18-page special report?
Yeah, that's the question that everyone is sort of asking right now. What is this really? What does it mean? What are the implications for all of this? And so when we started, it was a more general question about the future of money. And obviously, Bitcoin came to mind as a, you know, important piece of that. But as we got into it, it was very clear that the technology underneath Bitcoin, blockchain technology, had far more implications beyond Bitcoin and even beyond money itself. And, it, you know, this crosses policy and law and human behavior. And so it's a really fascinating topic that is expanding all the time.
Right. So let's start with some definitions. So Bitcoin is a digital or a cryptocurrency. Blockchain is the technology. Now, Bitcoin is just one of the digital currencies out there. Can you talk about that? You know, Bitcoin's obviously the main one. That's the one we hear about. But what other digital cryptocurrencies are out there?
Yeah, so if you've been, you know, following the sort of day-to-day news of this world, there is a ton of buzz and a ton of hype about which cryptocurrency is surging, which one might be becoming more dominant, which one is grappling with the, you know, the problems of the day that it's facing. And so there are many that are emerging to be interesting contenders. The question remains, are any of these currencies going to become actual usable money for ordinary people, or are they this sort of this curious and compelling asset that people are investing in and speculating on, and what will any of this amount to? And so, you know, it's really much more than the day-to-day, which one is up, which one is down.
Yeah. Jen, good morning. One of the things that I'd heard before your special came out, and then I read in your special report as well, is the extraordinary power, electricity that goes into the processing of the blockchain. And one of the things that that is written in one of the articles is that Bitcoin consumes as much electricity as eBay, Facebook, and Google combined just to authorize these many miners and make these things happen. Are there technologies coming? Are there blockchain efficiencies that will allow other cryptocurrencies to be more efficient?
That's a really great question. And what's interesting is even since we sent this issue to the printer, the Bitcoin network has grown, and so it's using even more energy. And there's been some predictions that if it keeps growing, you know, it could be using as much energy as the entire world uses within a couple of years or a few years. So that's obviously a really big problem. And part of what makes or what does make it so energy intensive is that the whole concept is that it's distributed. So instead of having one central authority operating it, it's distributed among thousands of individual computers and nodes worldwide. And that takes a lot of computing power to validate the whole system. So some of the new cryptocurrencies or some of the other ones are saying, well, let's make, instead of this public open network of strangers and computers, how about we have some validated computers and trusted people that it's a smaller network and therefore it uses less energy. So there's all sorts of ideas of how to, you know, make it less energy intensive, but that also makes it less decentralized. So there's trade-offs there. And in terms of technology, you know, innovating around this problem, I mean, we can look toward the future and look at, you know, perhaps quantum computing, but we're certainly not there yet, and that would introduce a whole other set of issues with the security of blockchain networks.
That would get us to a higher level of confusion that would be unimaginable.
That is true.
We've done a number of shows on quantum computing, and I can only imagine what that would add to the discussion of cryptocurrencies. Now, Bitcoin has no value, so its price is, I think, inherently unstable. We have all this gold sitting in Fort Knox. Outside of the good feelings that gold gives us, that it's there in Fort Knox. I mean, have we ever had to? I mean, you know, what value does this gold do in stabilizing the markets?
Well, you know, some people talk about Bitcoin as this modern form of gold, and that's not quite right because gold, of course, is this physical asset. But, you know, that launches an interesting question about where does the value of this digital currency come from? And, you know, like you said, it is inherently unstable. And so there's this really almost interesting philosophical debate we're entering right now of, how do you create value? Is it because we all believe it has value, mm-hmm. the faith in it having value? Is that the same faith we have in gold having value or the U.S. dollar? Well, obviously, those things are backed by government promises and a lot of policy and law. So, you know, cryptocurrencies are so new and the regulation has been so all over the place and, you know, non-existent for the most part that, you know, we don't really know how all of this is going to play out. So the value right now is based on really mostly it seems like a lot of excitement and interest. And as the traditional financial system becomes more interested in researching it and working it into their own protocols, it lends that legitimacy to it. So that's what it's really operating on right now, it seems.
So if Bitcoin is operating on the value of excitement, the gold standard to which we have been tied or our economy has been tied, or so we think, you know, it's the value of that is the amount that we've been able to trust, right? But we don't necessarily our economy is not held to the gold standard anymore because there's not enough gold in the world to back up our economy. So give me your thoughts on that, if you would.
Sure. So yeah, we haven't been working with the gold standard for a while now. And part of what is so interesting is that our monetary circuit and our financial systems have become incredibly complex. And that's part of the problem, is that in our existing structures, if you will, it's really difficult to model any of it. It's impossible to really model it to a level of detail that's necessary to really see the risks and the warning signs. Things like the mortgage crisis in 2008, it was really difficult to see coming. Now, some people think that if you apply some of this blockchain technology to our current financial system, you'll have a higher level of transparency. You'll be able to actually simulate all the possible outcomes of what could happen. And so there's this idea that it could fix some of the problems. Of course, it introduces new ones as well. What does it mean if we can see all the possible outcomes? What does it mean if a central bank can see the ways that everyone spends on every single purchase? So these are all questions people are, you know, rightfully concerned about.
Yeah, it's like we know what we know with the problems that exist, and that feels safer than not knowing what the problems may be out there in the future.
Certainly. And I think you see that with a lot of technologies that are very exciting. And there's, you know, some people say there's incredible promise, and there might be, but there's also a lot of peril. And so it's like anything else. You know, we really don't know how this is going to shake out, but sort of blind enthusiasm is not the way to go.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Jen Schwartz. She's the editor of a series of articles that has been written, a special group of articles on Bitcoin and the blockchain technology. You know, Jen, I'm always interested in the adoption rates of technology. I just find it fascinating. And the adoption of cryptocurrency, I mean, there's the normal amount of fear, uncertainty, and doubt, because it's not a technology which is, you know, really easy to understand. But your article, of course, answers a lot of questions, and I think it's a good primer for all of us. But there is a lot of fear and uncertainty, and I'm curious, it's kind of a two-part question. First of all, we have these millennials that have really adopted it a lot faster than other groups. And is that because of their interest in technology, or is that because of their lack of trust for the financial institutions that are in place today?
It's a really fascinating question. I'm actually a millennial myself, and one of the writers who contributed to this package is also a millennial, and she's a cultural anthropologist who works at a blockchain startup. And there is a lot of thought that millennials who sort of came of age in this post-recession economy and saw, you know, what they perceived as this real lack of accountability and this lack of trust might be more into the ideology behind some of these cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, where the original idea was to, you know, strip out the intermediaries and you could transact directly person to person. So there's a lot of sort of ideas around all that might seem quite compelling. However, as I've been reporting on this and you know, talking to other media, you have plenty of people who call in from all different ages and backgrounds who, you know, also don't trust the government or fear for an unknown future, and they think that this might be a more secure way to, you know, invest their money. Of course, if you don't understand this, and there are so many risks we don't know about, and it's so unregulated, and there are so many vulnerabilities, so it's quite a risky venture, I think, at this stage.
So the second part of the question is that the technology can be difficult to understand, and millennials do seem to adopt technology quicker than other groups. But the second part of the question is, are banking institutions fueling the fear, uncertainty, and doubt conversation because of the threat of all of this?
I think for a while there might have been some pushback, but now there's almost a tension. There's pushing back on it. They're saying this is not legitimate, this is a bubble, this is ridiculous. But there's also the thought of, well, but the technology is really interesting. And, you know, a lot of traditional financial, networks and systems are researching it and saying, well, is this a more efficient database that we could apply to our system? And so, you know, blockchain, everyone has to remember that blockchain ultimately is a technology. And so how it gets used and applied is really where the whole spectrum of uses and ideas and motivations come into play. So it's a really interesting and impressive technology, but it can be used for all certain, you know, reasons. And again, we really don't know sort of the limits of where this might go.
Yeah, and for me personally, I wasn't really interested in cryptocurrencies until I heard some banker say, trust me, this is not the way to go. Every time a banker says, trust me, you know, I'm kind of going the other way.
You know, that's a great point. And I think it's part of why this whole conversation is so muddied and is overwhelming to a lot of people, because who do you trust? And I think, you know, anyone who says that they understand this entire emerging ecosystem from the 30,000-foot view, that's not really quite right, because it really touches so many different areas of you know, academia and finance and law and, you know, and cryptography and mathematics. And it's so large, and because it's really imbued with this human element of who do we trust? Where's the future of trust and surveillance and all of this going and managing our data? And so it's really sort of tied up in this this storm of what will all of this end up meaning, and who can you trust in understanding what it means for you in your own life?
Right. Well, blockchain technology is supposed to do just that, is remove the element of trust. And yet trust is the very element that makes people scared of embracing this. I mean, most people, I think, who are older than the millennial generation would say, oh, this, you know, Bitcoin is for libertarians, drug dealers, and hackers, and therefore we don't trust it. And also, it is human nature, and I think prudent to a certain degree, to not trust anything that's in a bubble. I mean, Bitcoin, 2017, the year of the Bitcoin, and maybe 2018, but correct me if I'm wrong on these numbers, I think it started 2017 at under 1,000. And by the end of 2017, Bitcoin was at, I don't know, 18,000, 19,000. And I know it changes vastly every day.
Right. And now it's down, and it's incredibly hard to keep up. And now it's down at 13,000 or 14,000. I mean, and I would add, too, that there are plenty of millennials who don't understand this either. I think the sort of sweeping narrative is that the more you know about this and the more you learn, the more questions you have. And I think that's a healthy thing, but I think that's a sign that, we're not there yet and there's no final say at all about what any of this means. And I think skepticism and a desire to know more and ask more questions and have more research is, I think, where we're going to be going in 2018, and really sort of defining some of the terms and having some standards for all of this. Because, you know, a company right now can use the term blockchain and everyone's interested in it, but what does that really mean? And so I think there is the issue of informing the public about the scope of all of this and the concerns. So that's like the really tricky place that we're in now, to really talk about the technological side, but also all of the implications.
It's just staggering. John's across the desk from me, shaking his head and with his head in his hand, because it is staggering. It's you know, how can it's so difficult to embrace the complexity and the magnitude of this. So let's break it back to bring it down to something simple. Okay, over the holidays, one of my son's friends said, "Oh, you know, I know so and so Joe bought a pizza with Bitcoin at a local pizza place." How many retail commercial establishments that you know of, and where are these places where you're actually able to pay with Bitcoin?
So it's still pretty niche. and I think it's an interesting point you bring up, because the initial idea with Bitcoin is that it would be a true alternative currency that ordinary people could use to transact on a day-to-day basis. Now, you know, the fixation on it right now is really with it being this speculative asset, and how is it going to affect, you know, potentially the economy, and what are the, you know, fears that we might have of what could happen. But this idea that you could use it is still very niche, and it's really not in that many places, and I would say probably it's mostly a novelty, with the exception of, you know, some countries like Venezuela, where there's hyperinflation, and the people there, it's actually, you know, perhaps less risky maybe to put your money in Bitcoin, you know, rather than a hyperinflating national currency. So in countries like that, there are more places where it is accepted, like a grocery store or a car dealership. But I don't think you're really seeing that proliferation yet, certainly not in the U.S.
I'm shaking my head because I was just trying to get my arms around it. I'm actually very excited about it. I'm going to read your articles again and, you know, talk to some more people and see if I can get even closer to what this is all about. Now, on our program, we do not give out financial advice. But I'm curious, if somebody has a portfolio and they have a percentage, say 5 to 10% that they reserve for higher risk stuff, would you, you know, what do you think about someone putting some dough into this, either on the Chicago Exchange or, like, you know, what would you, you know, what sort of things would you think about? Again, we don't give financial advice, but you know, what's your personal feelings on this?
As a journalist and certainly not as a financial advisor, I also do not want to give any financial advice. You know, on a personal note, I am not invested in any of this. And partially, you know, as a journalist, I don't, you know, you don't want to get involved in something that you're covering. But, you know, it's something that to me is not, if you want to participate in the social experiment of all of this, and you want to kind of try to get your hands around a little bit the process of how this works, and you want to understand it a little bit better, so you want to put a little bit of money in just to sort of play around with how it works, if you're fully ready to lose all of that money, I would say fine, you know, go for it. Again, not giving advice, but just my personal idea of, if you're interested in trying to understand it a little bit better and getting involved in that world and seeing the tools and applications and digital wallets and exchanges, and that might be a good way to sort of wrap your head around it. If you, you know, put in a little and use it as sort of this experimental project. But, I mean, I don't know. I on a personal level, I don't have much of an interest in putting my money into cryptocurrencies.
Sure. In a peer-to-peer environment with Bitcoin, let's stay with Bitcoin, where the tremendous amounts of electricity are consumed in trying to authenticate. I don't even know if that's the right word, but for,
sure, yeah,
for this blockchain. Who pays for that?
So Bitcoin, the Bitcoin network operates on this mining protocol, and that means that the, you know, this huge decentralized network of computers, like you said, authorized, they're validating the transactions. So, you know, it used to be that you could have individual miners. You could get, you know, the computer. You could do it at home, and if you mined a block, part of the blockchain, then you would receive you know, a bit of Bitcoin in return for your effort. Now you have these huge mining pools, because the more computing power you put toward solving the math problems that make this whole network tick, the more likely you are to actually solve the problem and get Bitcoin as a reward. So there's this whole incentive structure built into the Bitcoin network, and so it costs a lot of money to run all these computers. So again, it's not about skills, not about humans with math skills. It's really just about using raw computing power to solve these complex, they're called hash functions. And so the more the network expands, the more electricity you need to run it. And that's why you see that the energy issue is becoming such a problem.
A couple of years ago, Ted Koppel, the journalist, wrote a book called Lights Out, and talking about the potential of a cyber attack and how unprepared we are as a nation if there were to be a blackout, cyber terrorism. And I'm just wondering, you know, the and I hadn't considered this before, but the amount of electricity and energy needed to run these digital currencies, you know, boy, that really presents a huge question. What would happen to our economy if there were a blackout? And perhaps that sounds a little bit paranoid thinking, but is it?
It's hard not to delve into this whole world and not start to have paranoid thinking. It's a little bit of the fun part of it is imagining and sort of projecting out into the future of all the things that could go wrong. And I think that's also the responsibility of a lot of people to look at what could go wrong. So the idea is that, at least with the Bitcoin network, that it's decentralized on a global scale. So that and that's highly intentional. If you have a geographic distribution, then, you know, if the U.S. had a blackout, you know, China perhaps wouldn't. And so, you know, the network itself, you know, unless we had a global blackout and the entire internet went down, you know, it's supposed to be the idea is that it's more secure than if, again, it's controlled and operated by a central server and a central system, if that makes sense. So in that regard, it is supposed to be more secure.
I tell you what, Lynn, I think, and Jen, I think that if we had a blackout that was caused by cyber, and it knocked out transformers that would take 1 or 2 years to have manufactured for you and brought over from China or wherever they come from, I think that Bitcoin would be the least of our worries. I think we'd be back in the dark ages if this country had to go for a year or two without power. It would be,
yeah.
you know, just turn on Mad Max, and that's basically what happens in 90 days.
Yeah, that's sort of the idea is that, you know, if the entire internet goes down, we have bigger problems as a world,
yeah,
than, you know, the status of the Bitcoin network.
I wanted to ask you also about how we currently in our economy use money several times over. We loan money, we take the money that has been loaned, we put it elsewhere, and it passes around in a big circuit, fractional banking. And with the use of digital currencies, that is sort of, is it absent, or how does it all play in that would continue a very important piece of our economy, which is this circuit?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the current system of fractional banking, as I said earlier, is incredibly complex. It's become incredibly complex with surging population and big data and all these sort of massive pieces of policy that you have to, you know, understand how they intersect with so many different factors. And so the idea is that fractional banking, if you look at it now, we have major problems. We have a lack of transparency. We have high-risk activities and exploitative practices. We have wealth where it's only in a small amount of people. So the idea is that blockchain technology could help alleviate some of those issues by making a database, making a network that is more transparent, and you would be able to use tools that could really, you would be able to see patterns and not just make models based on historical estimates, but you would actually be able to use all of the data that you have and see results and possible outcomes with much more clarity and a higher level of specificity. So the idea is not necessarily that money creation and fractional banking would go away. It's that the way that it operates could perhaps become a lot more clear.
Yeah, so something like the mortgage crisis back in 2008 or so, that would have been something that would have been brought into the light before it thrust us into a really huge economic crisis.
Yeah, so, you know, and I want to say, too, that all of this is, this is all potential. These are all possibilities and ideas. You know, we don't know if blockchain 10, 15 years from now is going to be something we look back at as though that was a flash in the pan and it didn't work out, or if it is, you know, it does have a lot of potential to change things for the better and, of course, for the worse, introduce new problems. And so, you know, it's hard to say, but yes, the idea, you know, and some of the academics and the, you know, computer scientists and quants and finance who look into this, you know, say, oh, well, if we had had this technology and we were able to create tools with it, you would be able to see risky behavior much more clearly in a system. You wouldn't be able to hide it. Of course, who is monitoring the behavior? Who is regulating it? And so ultimately, it also comes down to who are the humans and the entities that are even looking at the outcomes of this, of what this tool provides us. So again, you know, it's just a tool. And even though it could be used for great things, we don't know how this is all going to play out.
Well, I would direct our listeners to the January issue of Scientific American. There's an 18-page special report, a handful of different articles, you know, from, gosh, you've got computer scientists to anthropologists writing or contributing articles to this special report. So, Jen Schwartz, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. What a fascinating topic. And it must feel for you like the culmination of the work and the knowledge that you have amassed since 2011 or so.
It's the more I learn, the more questions I have, and that's what makes this so fascinating. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well,
thanks
for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Wow. How about that? Are you more clear now?
I am, and I'm still going to reread the articles, and I think they're fascinating. I think this is the first time I've actually been able to grog what's going on. It's very, very clear.
Yes, absolutely. So Scientific American, the January issue, run out and grab that if you, you know, I when we were preparing for this interview, we were down at the coffee shop speaking to a couple of people, and they said, you know, I've paid attention, I've read a few things, I've listened to reports, and I still don't get it. And so it's unfortunate that we didn't start back in 2011 researching it like Jen did, but, you know, we can catch up.
Yeah.
Just ask the millennials, right?
We were busy with other stuff, Lynn.
We were. Other valuable stuff.
Oh.
All right. Well, stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters. It's Cool Science Radio.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, happy to keep KPCW Radio and their staff running smoothly. We provide sales and maintenance on all computer systems and can guide our customers about cloud solutions for their businesses or personal computer needs. More info available at 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
Hi, this is Shelley Barris, Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity. Do you have gently used furniture, appliances, cabinets, or building materials that need a new home? Donate them to the Habitat Restore and help local hardworking families. You can bring your items to us or schedule a pickup at 435-658-1400. We are a nonprofit and proud to be a KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Interesting conversation we just had with Jen Schwartz of Scientific American. A casual drink here and one there. First it was one glass after a long day, but now it's more. The obligatory cocktail at the office party was enjoyable and now seems strenuous. The new book, This Naked Mind, is the book for all those people who question whether drinking has become too big a part of their lives. It takes a look at why we drink, how marketing has made drinking a social pressure rather than pleasure, what alcohol actually does to the body, and why it is the only drug that one has to explain not taking. The author of This Naked Mind, Annie Grace, is a voice of reason who changes the conversation about drinking by dismantling the preconceived notions about why we drink and provides readers with a healthier relationship to alcohol, whether that means cutting back on drinking or stopping altogether. She joins us. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
So let's just kick off with this quickly before we get into the science of it all. Your story, you were 26 years old. Take it from there.
Yeah, I was the youngest vice president in a multinational company, and I was not a big drinker at the time. I was basically told that the bar was a lot like the golf course. You needed to go out and drink and keep up. That's where your ideas could get heard. And I was told this by my boss at the time. And so I was very passionate about my job. I didn't have any real caution around alcohol. My parents didn't drink. So I went ahead and took it in earnest and tried to develop a tolerance, keep up. And, you know, fast forward a decade, drinking at social events and networking events became drinking at home. Suddenly I thought it was easier to pour a glass of wine than put on my running shoes to deal with a hard day. And I found myself drinking far more than I ever intended to. And as a mother of two young kids at the time, it became like, wow, where is this going? And I kind of woke up to it.
And Annie, I wanted to ask you, if I was to watch TV and a commercial comes on and they have this guy walking into a beautifully lit bar and restaurant, and he meets cool friends and smart, hip women and all of those sorts of things, you know that that's not going to happen to you. You know that consciously. But I found it fascinating in your book when you talk about the difference between the conscious and the subconscious. As you say, drinking is not a fully conscious decision because you may consciously decide to stop or to restrict the amount of alcohol that you have. But the subconscious mind has been educated, conditioned for years with some of this propaganda. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's fascinating because although alcohol kills, you know, four times as many people as all illegal drugs, we would never see a commercial for cocaine or something like that on the television. And so we say, but we look at those commercials, you know, commercials expounding ridiculous things, and we say, oh no, that doesn't affect me. And honestly, alcohol is one of the highest spend categories in advertising, and it wouldn't be that way if it wasn't selling alcohol. There's a very direct correlation between how much money the alcohol industry is spending, especially in certain segments. They're spending more than ever on women because they've seen it as an underserved audience, and women are drinking more than ever. They're spending more than ever on college-age individuals, and again, drinking more than ever. And so while it doesn't affect us consciously, we can dismiss it. It is in our conscious mind that they're targeting. It's very subliminal. It's very subconscious. And the subconscious mind absorbs far more information that kind of comes back and surfaces. And then you develop these beliefs that are founded on sort of your experiences, your observations, and your conclusions. And suddenly, out of almost nowhere, you believe that you need alcohol to socialize or to date or to have a good time or to relax. And that didn't happen overnight. It happened as accumulation of all sorts of different input to the subconscious.
Yeah, you talk about overdosing on alcohol. We know that you can overdose in one sitting with, you know, you can have alcohol poisoning. But something that I read in your book, you know, about that alcohol poisoning over time where it's accumulating in your body. And this is why, you know, moderate drinkers get to that tipping point. You call it the liminal point of going from moderate to poisoned, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. Alcohol builds up over time, as does sort of our response to it. And one of the more interesting things is that our body trying to purge alcohol from our system and get rid of it, we actually create a counter chemical called acetaldehyde. And acetaldehyde is so toxic that it would be banned by the FDA. We'd never allow ourselves to ingest it. But it's created in large amounts from our bodies trying to get rid of the alcohol. So this acetaldehyde is what really destroys kind of our internal thing. And over time, you can overdose just by drinking cumulatively too much, as well as obviously alcohol poisoning in the moment, which is something that I think very few people know and is quite terrifying.
I'd like to mention to our listeners that throughout the book are a number of studies that have been done. There's science here and peer-reviewed science. And one of the things that came up when you talk about the conscious and subconscious is that if you decide that you want to drink or stop drinking or limit your drinking, your subconscious may not have gotten the memo, as you say, and you become in conflict. So you try to rely on your willpower. And you cite a study in there where willpower is not a finite type of energy. It is finite.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the biggest sources of misinformation is that we believe we just need more willpower. We just had more willpower. We could stop. We could get to levels that we're comfortable with. But the truth is willpower, new studies show, exercises much more like a muscle. So if you fatigue your willpower because you've been trying not to drink, you're more likely to yell at your children later because it's not situation specific. It's almost overall. Equally, if you've had a really hard day at the office, you're going to have a much harder time resisting that second or third drink. So my work is really about getting out of the willpower game altogether, because you only need willpower when you are saying no to something you believe provides a benefit. You know, we don't need any willpower to say, I'm not going to drink that, you know, can of motor oil, because we don't think it was going to be any benefit. And so if we can undo our thinking, mostly unconscious, about the benefits we believe alcohol provides by looking at the science of, is that really true? Does it relax me neurologically? Does it relax me physiologically? Then we undo that thinking, and suddenly there's no willpower needed, because we don't believe there's any benefit any longer.
So viewing alcohol as poison, and that's essentially what it is doing in our bodies, is sort of the flip side of saying, oh, I just have a glass of wine every now and again to relax. So, what is the fallacy? Because I think that thought about, oh, a glass of wine every now and again becomes two glasses of wine, and it becomes more frequent, and suddenly we are asking ourselves, am I drinking too much?
Well, I think alcohol, you know, we all know about tolerance, but we don't really understand that tolerance is literally the body's immunity to alcohol. It's how the body protects itself. Mm-hmm. It says, okay, I must be forced to drink this because it doesn't do good things. So I'm going to learn how to process it and get it out as effectively as possible, how to protect myself from it. And so that one glass on occasion used to have the effect to numb your brain, maybe effectively for a little bit of time, but suddenly it doesn't, because your body has learned how to process it quicker to try to immunize itself from the alcohol. And so over time, you need two glasses or three glasses. And this sort of only goes one direction. And so that's really why it's such a difficult thing to just, you know, drink on occasion. Your drinking increases simply because your body learns how to process it better, and you stop feeling the same effects from the amount of alcohol you were drinking previously.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Annie Grace. She's written a fascinating book, This Naked Mind, Control Alcohol, Find Freedom, Discover Happiness, and Change Your Life. Annie, if I were to take a piece of paper and draw a straight line left to right, and on the far, it's a continuum, and on the far right, I had serious alcoholism, where people bottom out and, you know, things happen that are not good for the individual. And on the far, far left, I had the soccer mom that goes out with the girls once a month, has a single glass of wine, and that's it for alcohol consumption. There's the sweet spot in between those two, where over time, addictive behavior has increased the amount of alcohol that they drink, and people seem to find that they have more trouble controlling it. How big is that sweet spot? How many people are wrestling with this type of problem? They're not bottom-out alcoholics, and they're not soccer moms having one glass of wine. There's something else.
Yeah, absolutely. It's massive. I mean, it's absolutely huge. Just to give you an idea, the definition of excessive drinking by the CDC for women is 8 glasses of wine per week. And if, you know, most people having a glass of wine at dinner are going to have a nice heavy pour, and that's going to be over that limit. And so of excessive drinkers, the people who actually have the problem with alcohol and who are physically dependent, so need something beyond just the book, need some additional help, it's only 10%. So 90% of people drinking a single glass of wine, a nice pour every night, are going to fall into that range of drinking at levels that are no longer good for them, no longer making them feel great, but are not physically dependent.
So I would assume then that this is the population of people that are most eluded by their consumption and not realizing that it is in excess. So what are the questions that we need to ask ourselves to answer that question, am I drinking too much?
Yeah, and I was smack dab in this population. I was drinking exactly as much as my colleagues, exactly as much as my friends, exactly as much as everybody around me. So there was nothing to indicate that I was on any end of the spectrum. And so I think the most important question is just ask yourself, are you 100% comfortable with how much you're drinking? Because there is some cognitive dissonance that starts to form when you know that it's more than it should be, when you feel hungover a little bit too much, when you've lost some of your energy. And the reason that I think we have so much fear around that question is because we believe if we say no, then that means we're in that 10% that need, you know, meetings every day and that we have to declare ourselves alcoholic. And the fear around that question almost encourages us not to ask the question. But the truth is, and according to research, is that the majority of people can get back in control or quit altogether without a lot of intervention, with just kind of getting their head back on straight and undoing their thinking. And so that question doesn't need to be as fearful as we've made it. And, you know, if we were sitting down to a plate of donuts, we'd talk about the calories. We'd want to limit ourselves to just one, so we'd have a balanced conversation about it. But when we're sitting down to, you know, glasses of Chardonnay, we're not having that balanced conversation. It becomes really taboo if you say, oh, you know, I don't know, I might be drinking too much. Everybody sort of says, oh, are you okay? Do we need to worry? Because we've made it anybody who's drinking too much fits that definition of alcoholic. And that's just not true. And so taking the fear out of that question, being able to be honest with yourself because you can realize that there's another alternative, I think is absolutely the most important. And then secondly, very briefly, I'd say, if you are drinking to relieve stress or to self-medicate, you should look at it. And this is why, is because it just doesn't do what it says, you know, on the tin, so to speak. It doesn't actually relieve stress. There's a very brief period of time, about 30 minutes, when you drink a drink that your blood alcohol is rising and you feel some nice euphoric feelings. But then there's 2 to 3 hours with that very same drink where your blood alcohol is falling and your adrenaline kicks in and your cortisol kicks in and you feel, that's why it's a depressant. You feel quite negative feelings for 2 to 3 hours. So we end up drinking that second drink to combat that fall in blood alcohol. And then we don't realize this because often we fall asleep during the worst of the blood alcohol falling. And so alcohol is not relieving your stress. You wake up feeling less energy and worse the next day and you wonder why. And it's just because over time. So if you're drinking to self-medicate, to deal with stress, that is certainly somewhere you might want to take a look.
Annie, there's a tremendous amount of study going on in brain science, and we've had a number of shows on it. I find this conscious and subconscious mind in conflict to be absolutely fascinating. One of your experiences was excruciating back pain, and you were introduced to Dr. John Sarno's books. Maybe you can talk about that and about how this is being applied to different challenges.
Yeah, it's really the foundation of all my work because I was at the same time where I was realizing I was drinking more than I wanted to be drinking and didn't understand why I needed it and wanted it when I didn't used to. I was also dealing with this just horrible back pain. I tried everything. I was introduced to Dr. Sarno's book, and he made the point that often your body can cause pain unconsciously to protect you from feelings that you don't believe you should feel. So feelings you think are negative or abhorrent, and so your body physically causes pain. And so when I read this book and my unconscious got this memo, so to speak, my pain went away, and it was one of my first experiences with the power of the mind and how there are things going on inside of us that we're not consciously aware of, and it was absolutely enlightening. So I actually reached out to Dr. Sarno, was put in touch with somebody who's written some books with Dr. Sarno, and said, hey, would this work for something like drinking? And they said, absolutely. You've always seen this connection. This would absolutely work. What you need to do is you need to understand that the way to change your unconscious mind is by bringing the things that are unconscious into conscious awareness. So just going back through, okay, why do I believe alcohol relaxes me? Where did I pick that belief up? How does it manifest in my life? And then saying, is that true? You know, both internally, do I actually feel relaxed the next day? And externally, what is the science saying? What is the research saying? And so by doing that, you surface these unconscious beliefs, and they really can let go of you in this profound way where you suddenly realize it's not relaxing me. So the next time you reach for a drink to relax, you have no desire for that drink because you know that that drink is just going to make the situation worse.
Mm-hmm. Before we let you go, I just want to mention some of the other resources connected to This Naked Mind, thisnakedmind.com. You have a blog, you have a podcast, and one of the recent episodes of the podcast is end-of-year interviews, people who have gone through, have read your book, who have changed their lives, and I'm wondering if you can just run through, you know, what, when you hear the stories, what impacts you most that you hear?
I think as a parent, it's really the children. It's the people whose stories, they felt empowered and they're noticing that passed on to their kids. Because these, it's very common in this day and age to, you know, even drink with your 17-year-old or 18-year-old because you think, well, if he does it with me, it won't get as out of control later. The science says that's just not true. It's actually the opposite. And so when you realize that and you start to provide, you know, you can tell kids to do one thing, but what you actually do and what the example you show is so much more profound. And so the stories I get about people's children actually looking at alcohol in a different way because the parent has changed, I say hands down, kind of gives me the most hope and joy and just like sense of, oh, that's amazing. And there's so many of those stories.
Nice. The book is This Naked Mind, Control Alcohol, Find Freedom, Discover Happiness, and Change Your Life. And Annie Grace, wonderful to speak with you, and it's really great to see the work that you're doing. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
Again, Annie Grace and the book, This Naked Mind. Really quite a book. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, this is Steve Roney, owner of Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. I'm a proud resident of Park City and a loyal supporter of KPCW and all it does for our community. Our agents in Summit and Wasatch counties can be reached at any of our 30 offices or at our website, bhhsutah.com.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells. Thank our underwriters, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Nexus IT, the Habitat for Humanity Restore, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, FredMarshallPainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.